History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned, of course, is that they really don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask the right questions and then invest the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 97-year-old John Stokes of San Leandro, California is a member of that generation. If you've ever visited the World War II Liberty ship SS Jeremiah O'Brien in San Francisco, perhaps Mr. Stokes was your docent, or maybe he helped you out at a Montgomery Ward store once upon a time, or maybe you got to greet him at San Francisco's airport when he returned from his recent honor flight experience. Today we're going to hear his experiences in the Navy Armed Guard aboard merchant ships during World War II, but as always, we like to start back at the beginning. So let's hear about your childhood, Mr. Stokes.
I was born and raised in San Francisco. I went to Douglas Grammar School and Jefferson Grammar School and Lincoln High School. In fact, I left Lincoln. I didn't graduate. Left when I was 17 to go in the Navy.
And there were some things happening around the city then that maybe we take for granted now. I mean, the most iconic visual of San Francisco is the Golden Gate Bridge, but you must have seen it getting built when you were a kid.
I saw both bridges being built. When I was in Douglas Grammar School, I probably was in the second or third grade, and I was watching the Bay Bridge going up, and then the Golden Gate Bridge was a little behind the Bay Bridge, and they had some pretty big ceremonies and stuff for it, but I never went to any of those things.
You had a twin sister growing up. That must have made things fun. Can you give us a perspective on what life was like back then, some of the things you guys did, or maybe the hopes and dreams you had way back when?
As twins, our real names, like mine was John Edward, and her name was Elsie Jacqueline, but they called us Jack and Jacqueline. I went by the nickname of Jack all through high school. When I went in the Navy, my real name was John, so I had to go by John. So I thought, well, I might as well stick with John. But I did get, in high school, that nickname I told you was Swisher.
Well, and you've got to tell us how that nickname came about, Swisher. That's, well, some people may have some ideas. Why did they call you Swisher?
Well, I played basketball, and somebody was looking for me, and I had a job with a shoemaker learning how to repair shoes on Irving Street in San Francisco, and there was a newsboy, and I can't think of his name now, but somebody asked him Jack was, and he says, oh, you mean Swisher, and he started calling me, and so everybody called me Swisher. When they wrote me up in the Chronicle for sports, they'd always put Jack Swisher Stokes. I don't know whether it was because I was so bad or I was so good.
Well, if they were writing about you, it must have been the latter, would be my guess. That sounds like something you really enjoyed. Did you have some ambitions of hey, basketball is something I'm going to be doing for a long time?
No, I don't think I really gave it a lot of thought at that time. And then the war came along, naturally. And
I want to ask you about December 7th, 1941. I know everybody who was alive has a memory of that. But before we get to that, you had a more recent experience with Honor Flight Bay Area. And one of the stops that you made in Washington, D.C., made a connection with your father's military service. And some people might not guess what that connection is. Why don't you tell me about that and what your father did in the military before you were ever born?
My dad ran away from home when he was about 13 or 14. He lied about his age and joined the Navy. And he went through the Navy, and the Boxer Rebellion came along, and his ship that he was on went to that Boxer Rebellion. What he actually did, I don't know, but that was the where I connect with him on that monument because it mentions the different campaigns, and one of them was the Boxer Rebellion, and on the other side of the monument is the Okinawa. So we were in both campaigns.
So this is the Marine Corps War Memorial in Washington, D.C., where the statue on top, of course, is a famous scene from Iwo Jima and Mount Suribachi, but that's dedicated to all the Marines in combat since 1775, and it's got the Boxer Rebellion and World War One and Two, and as you said, Okinawa. And your father grew up in England, right?
Yeah, up until he was decided to come. I don't know how old he was when he came to the United States, but He was an immigrant that came through. The way he talked to me, he must have landed on the East Coast, and he got a job in Canada with the railroad. And at that time, it was sort of a subscription deal. You signed a contract, and you were supposed to stay. But he didn't. Him and a guy got one of those hand cars and escaped, so to speak. And he beat his way to Vancouver, and then he took a ferry and came into Seattle. He pretended he was a crew member when he went ashore, and that's how he came into the United States illegally. But he did get his citizenship. And just a side note there, he went back to England to visit his family, and he decided to come back home on the Titanic. And the last minute, he changed his mind. Thank goodness for me. I wouldn't be here otherwise. Yeah. So then he came home on the following ship.
Boy, he had quite a story. So just to get that straight, so everybody is saying, wait, did I just hear what I think I heard? So he came over, went across Canada, came into the U.S. illegally, would eventually earn his citizenship by serving in the Navy, but was going to get on the Titanic, and something told him, don't do that.
Yeah, from England, he was coming back to the States. How he got over to England, I don't know what ship he came out
of. Well, he sounds like a fascinating guy, and I want to hear your memories. I've talked to a lot of people who were around the Bay Area in December 1941. You're less than a week away from your 16th birthday, and all of a sudden, the world changes a little bit. What do you remember about that day, December 7th?
I remember it was a Sunday, and I'd gone to church. When I came back home from Sunday school, we lived on 18th Avenue in San Francisco. We had a really palatial home there. I was down in the basement. My room was right off the basement. The house was terraced. So I remember my dad coming down the back stairs from the kitchen to the basement, and I was playing around with my chemistry set as a kid, you know. So, and he said, the Japs, I shouldn't use that word, I guess, but attacked Pearl Harbor. So I said, oh, gee. So I got on my bike and went over to my friend's house to let him know, my best buddy, but he wasn't there. So, but that I remember pretty vividly what happened. And what happened after that, the next day was Monday, naturally. And I remember going to school. And I remember hearing President Roosevelt talk to Congress and declare war on both Germany and Japan. Little did I know at that time I'd be in the service.
Well, and probably little did you know how life around here would change, because I imagine you probably had to black out at night and all that, thinking the Japanese were coming here.
Well, I can tell you a story about that, too. I remember the blackouts. The bedroom I had downstairs, that's the room we were supposed to go to if there was a problem. I think we had three or four windows in that room. We had plywood to cover it for a blackout. When I joined the Navy, I was saying goodbye to some of my relatives when it was really foggy, and it was, you know, you could drive your car, but you had to use running lights, not the big lights. I couldn't see, so I flashed my headlights to see. There was a civilian. They blew a whistle and pulled me over and gave me a ticket.
Well, and I guess I should ask you, too, what was it that made you want to join the Navy? Because you could have kept going to school. You were only 17. Why did you want to go in and serve that way?
Well, I wasn't the best student in school. Being 17, the war's going on, thinking, I'll be 18, but I'll still be in high school because I still have a year to go because I had been left behind in grammar school a couple of grades. And this buddy of mine, he was in the same boat I was in. I guess we were just dumb kids at the time. I'm not sure. But his name was Forrest Rhodes. He was about 5'3", and I was 6'3". They called us Mutton Jeff. So we got to talk, and we says, you know, they might draft us out of high school. Because I think they were doing that then, you know, if you were 18. He said, maybe we ought to join the Navy. I said, yeah, maybe we should. So we got our parents' permission, and we joined. I went through boot camp okay, but when I came back to Farragut, they put us in what they called an outgoing unit, OGU, and in that, you waited around for the draft to come up to send you somewhere. Unfortunately, there were so many men in Farragut at that time, they didn't have enough barracks to house us all. When I came back off leave to go to OGU, they put us in the drill hall because there wasn't enough barracks around to house us. And that's where I guess I got sick. It was my sinus problem. And I had a fever and all that. And I was all ready for the draft to go to Chicago to radio school. I was really enthused about that because my buddy, he got a draft that he had to go right to a pre-ship building to go to sea. And he did go through about five campaigns. Anyway, I went into the dispensary. Then they decided to put me in the hospital. And I was in the hospital for, I'd say, probably 2 or 3 weeks. They had a lot of sickness up there. There was a lot of guys dying. Anyway, and after I got out of the hospital, because I gotten back where I was ready for duty, and I went on a liberty, and I wasn't feeling good. I went, turned myself into the shore patrol and told them I can't get back to the base because I'm sick and so on. So they drove me back to the base, and I checked in, and I had pneumonia. Then on top of that, the pneumonia turned into pleurisy, and so I was in the hospital there for about probably 4 to 6 weeks. And I kept wondering, when am I going to go back to duty, because I felt pretty good. And the nurse told me, you're not going back to duty. You're going to California to a convalescent hospital. So I thought, oh, gee, okay. So I went to Corona, California. They had a naval hospital there. They took over a country club and made it into a hospital. I was there probably for about a month. I thought, well, they'll send me to duty, and I'll probably go to San Pedro because I was only a seaman second class, hadn't had a rate. They'll probably put me in the armed guard. They said, well, we're going to send you back to duty, but you're going back to Farragut. There's been a new ruling that we send everybody back to where they came from. So that was a real surprise, you know. So I got on a one-man draft on the train to Farragut, got back in Farragut, and there was a lieutenant commander doctor. He called me and he remembered me. He says, Stokes, we know what your problem is. Your tonsils, we're going to take them out. So that quite possibly could have been it. And so they did take my tonsils out, and basically I hadn't been sick until I got in my old age, you know. So, but that delayed me, and my buddy had already been on a ship going to sea. I didn't see him again until after the war was over, but I mean, that's how much time had passed. I thought, well, I got on a draft again from OGU to go to Shoemaker, California, which was in Pleasanton, and that was close to home. But when we got there, they issued us some green uniforms, you know, with fatigues. So I thought, well, I guess maybe I'm going to an island or something, you know, rather than the regular Navy uniform. So I called my folks, and they came over on the Sunday to visit me with my twin sister, and I said my goodbyes and all that, and then The next day was Monday. I was in San Francisco ringing the doorbell on my house, telling my folks I got 3 months temporary duty at the Fleet Post Office so I could live at home. So that was pretty great, you know. So the time was going. I had over a year in the Navy, probably 18 months, and I hadn't gone anywhere, to be truthful with you. After the Fleet Post Office, I went there to Treasure Island, and that's when I got in the Armed Guard. And that was in 1944. Then I went into a special detail, which was called the Hatchman-Winchman Detail. We were actually stevedores. We learned how to operate the winches, how to load the cargo nets, and so on. And I guess this was something new that we didn't know about, but it was a school they had in Treasure Island that we went to for a couple of weeks, and learning how to operate the winches and how to do tie knots, things like that. So then we got our orders to go to Seattle. Then we went to Kelso, Washington, and we were assigned to a ship. And that was the Saginaw Victory. And it was right out of the shipyard. It was built in Portland. And they were loading ammunition on it. You know, being a kid, you don't think too much about the problems that there might be on an ammunition ship. But unfortunately, the ships were built where they had quarters for the armed guard gunners and for the merchant crew and for the radio operators or signalmen or whatever else. But they really didn't have space on the ship for a special team like us of the 15 guys. So they put doghouses, what they call doghouses, on the boat deck. And there was each doghouse could sleep 8 people. No electricity, though, just a locker and a bed. And it was tack welded to the deck. When we were in a storm, I used to see my shoes float back and forth. So it wasn't the best accommodations for us guys, for us 15. But anyway, we survived that.
And there would be a few more hair-raising moments to survive once he ended up at Okinawa in 1945. We'll hear some of those memories from 97-year-old Navy veteran John Stokes when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.